Hey everyone, welcome back to the Period Chats podcast. We are finally back after a 2-week break. Thank you for being patient with me while I was traveling and enjoying myself. I definitely feel refreshed and excited to be back. And today we're going to be talking about something that you guys have heard me talk a lot indirectly about, SIBO, or small intestinal bacteria overgrowth. This is something that I'm just finding more and more as I see my own clients and then with my own journey with it, is just something that is stubborn, hard to deal with, and really hard to navigate. And there's a lot of misinformation on the internet. So I couldn't think of anyone better than my friend Erin, who I met at the very early days of Funkit when I was kind of navigating this whole new territory, another dietitian I really love and respect. So I brought Erin on. She focuses on gut health and talks a lot about SIBO. So it's going to be an exciting ride. Buckle up. I'm going to let Erin introduce herself, and then we're going to jump right into all the questions you guys submitted.
Yeah. Kate, thanks so much for having me. And I can also share my own personal journey. I have had SIBO myself in the past. And as a registered dietitian, really a lot of the reason why I started doing the work that I do is because I had horrible digestive issues for the majority of my life. And no one was really understanding what the root cause was or doing any sort of, you know, functional lab testing. It was really your more conventional standard treatment. And, you know, here I am today now helping individuals work on their root cause and take a very holistic approach. So I'm excited to be here to chat with you today and answer any questions. This is definitely a very controversial and complex topic.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So I'll give you guys a little background. So I got food poisoning when I was traveling about a year and a half ago. My SIBO symptoms, which really my main SIBO symptom was just extreme bloating and pain and distension, like basically from the time I woke up to the time I went to sleep. I have methane dominant SIBO, and I've also been going down the holistic route of dealing with it because when I started reading research, there's so much conflicting research about the best way to approach SIBO. So that's kind of a little bit of a teaser about what we'll be talking about. But can you tell us what SIBO is and how it's diagnosed first, right off the bat, to make sure everyone knows what it is before we jump into all the different ways that we talk about it and what it impacts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, SIBO is in some way that I think is gaining a lot more attention. It's interesting, you know, IBS is such a common, now seeing in the research that up to 70% of people who have IBS actually have SIBO as their underlying root cause. So SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, is a condition where there's overgrowth in bacteria in the small intestine. So most of the bacteria that we have in our gut, when we say gut, we're talking about small, large intestine, remain in the large intestine. And so it's when these bacteria either migrate or somehow become overgrown in the small intestine that we see small intestinal bacterial overgrowth diagnosis. And what happens is these types of bacteria can produce excess types of gas, whether it's hydrogen, methane, hydrogen sulfide, and those can create a lot of unpleasant symptoms. As Kate mentioned, you know, methane dominant SIBO typically associated with a lot of bloating or constipation. And the best way to diagnose SIBO is through a breath test. And we could probably do a whole episode on breath testing alone. There's a lot of mixed reviews and even research on, you know, different types of breath tests using different types of substrates like lactulose versus glucose. But really the only way that we can diagnose SIBO, like in a non-invasive way, is from doing a breath test.
Yes. And the breath test, if anyone's done it, is a pain in the butt. You breathe into this tube for like 6 hours or no, it's like 3 hours, but it's like every 20 minutes and you have to drink this gross. I think I did the lactulose one. It's like the orange nasty liquid. But yeah, so that's what SIBO is. That's how you diagnose it. But now let's get into, what does SIBO feel like? You touched on that a little bit, and I'm so glad you brought up IBS. Because this is something I get asked about a lot, like, oh, I have an IBS diagnosis, and I always have to bite my tongue because I'm like, okay, they didn't ask you, so maybe let's just take it easy. But a lot of times I'm like, well, that's a totally valid diagnosis, but have you looked any deeper? Because I've had quote-unquote IBS my entire life, and I never got any relief until I started dealing with the different SIBO symptoms that I have. So you touched on a little bit, like the bloating, the constipation. Are there any other things to look out for with SIBO that maybe are commonly like why they're diagnosed as IBS?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. There's so much overlap between the symptoms. If you put the symptoms side by side between IBS and SIBO, they're pretty much equal. You know, the differentiation between SIBO and IBS is oftentimes, you know, small little nuances like maybe some vitamin nutrient deficiencies like B12 and iron, due to the fact that the small intestine is where the majority of our nutrients are absorbed. So symptoms of SIBO might include the bloating that you talked about, feeling really full pretty quickly after meals, tightness in your abdomen, which you could wake up with this type of discomfort, or oftentimes with SIBO patients, we tend to see that the bloating or symptoms typically worsen throughout the day as they eat, because they're fueling those different bacteria and they're having those bacteria create more gas throughout the day. General abdominal pain or discomfort, things like excessive gas, especially bilic acid gas, belching due to the fermentation of the undigested food by these bacteria, diarrhea, constipation. And then patients might also experience things like, you know, fatigue, chronic fatigue, because, you know, of nutrient malabsorption of the body's immune system, you know, having a response in bacterial overgrowth. Some people might feel nauseous after meals. They could even have some vomiting if it's fairly extreme. Acid reflux or heartburn can often be related to SIBO. A lot of people don't realize that. And then experiencing a lot of food sensitivities. So this is, you know, especially the case if a client comes to me and they say, you know, I used to be able to eat anything, and now all of a sudden I can't eat bananas or avocados, or, you know, forget fermented foods. Like, those are some red flags that someone might have that underlying root cause.
I love that you brought that up, because that was something, like, I used to have a quote unquote like iron stomach. I could eat anything, and now I feel like my stomach is so fragile because it's so dependent on what I eat. The other thing I wanted to define before we move into this, because I find this is a common misconception, can you define constipation? Because I actually feel like a lot of people I talk to don't think they're constipated, and then we talk about it and they're like, oh, I'm supposed to be going to the bathroom how many times a day? It's supposed to look like what?
Yes. So this is, I actually find that a lot of clients end up in my office when they learn that what their bowel movements were like are not actually normal. And I think part of that is because gastroenterologists, for example, or even, you know, conventional medicine doctor has normalized having a bowel movement every 3 days. So they'll say, oh, you know, everyone has their own normal. It's not, you know, necessarily a concern. But you should be having at least 1 to 2 bowel movements per day. So the actual, like, definition of constipation would be having infrequent bowel movements, and you having difficulty passing stools, fewer than 3 bowel movements a week. I mean, absolutely not. That should not be happening. If you look at the Bristol stool chart, this is a good way to figure out if you could be constipated. There's different types of bowel movements. So you look at this visual, like a type 1, type 2, when the bowel movements are maybe really hard, really pebbly, really compact, that is a sign of constipation. And some of the symptoms that also might come is, you know, having to strain a lot. Sounds good. So constipation. So looking at that Bristol stool chart, seeing what you are in terms of, like, the type of bowel movement, right. There should be no difficulties. You shouldn't have to be straining. You shouldn't be bearing down while you're having a bowel movement. Most people know, like, when they're constipated, when they'll say things like, you know, they don't have that feeling of complete evacuation. You can still have a bowel movement every day and be constipated. A lot of people don't realize that, but just because you're going in every day doesn't mean that they're not constipated. And I've had this, you know, there was a client that I worked with, and this is, you know, lucky that she was able to get a CT scan to find this out, but she had no thought in her mind that she was constipated, went in to get a CT scan, and they said, oh my goodness, you are completely backed up, you know, using the term full of, you know, poop, basically. And she was like, I had no idea. Because you can still have that daily bowel movement, and there can still be a lot of backup there, and that can also increase your risk for something.
That's so interesting, because obviously I said I already have SIBO, but I went to the gynecologist, like, that was a couple months ago. I did not think I was constipated at all, and I had to have, like, a internal, like, vaginal ultrasound because I was having pain on my ovary. And she was like, no, 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 it's not anything to do with your ovary. It's that you're constipated and it's pushing on your ovary. And so, like, the whole issue was actually, like, because I was going to the bathroom every day, I didn't think I was constipated. But she's like, oh, no, no, there's a lot in here and you need to, like, work on that first. So that was really interesting because I have 1 to 2 bowel movements every day. Felt, like, totally satisfied with them, but still was constipated and didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So nutrient deficiencies are a hot topic. You know, there's all of these different ways to test for them, like hair mineral testing. But tell me more about nutrient deficiencies and SIBO, because we're going to obviously be getting into hormone health in a minute. And I think that laying the foundation for these nutrient deficiencies and why they matter is so important, because a lot of people don't know that gut health, hormone health, nutrient absorption, it's all tied up in the gut. Literally, it's all done right there.
Yeah, one of my favorite things is when clients go through my program and at the end they're like, oh my gosh, my periods are more regular and, you know, I'm not spotting as much. And they're like surprised and I'm over here like, I knew that would happen. because it is, it's true. Everything is connected. And the nutrient deficiency side of things is really important when we talk about bacterial overgrowth. And this could be other types of overgrowth as well, not just SIBO. You know, you could have SIFO, which is fungal overgrowth in the small intestine. But as mentioned earlier, the small intestine is the site of where we are absorbing the majority of our nutrients, particularly things like vitamin A, D, E, iron, calcium, B12, and all of these different types of nutrients are essential for quite literally everything when you're talking about optimal health, including hormone balance. And so when you have overgrowth in this area, you can kind of think of those like a competition for absorption of those nutrients. And so if you have those bacteria crowding out, creating inflammation, potentially even, you know, causing damage to the little villi in the small intestine that are where we absorb those nutrients, over time, this can lead to nutrient deficiencies. And sometimes this is how we can differentiate an IBS diagnosis versus a SIBO diagnosis, because IBS isn't always going to be associated with things like iron deficiency or B12 or folate, whereas SIBO might be.
Interesting. Okay. I actually didn't know that, but the diagnostic differentiators. So then how does this relate to hormone health? Because that's a question I get a lot. Like, well, that's a gut issue. It's not really, I want to talk about balancing my hormones. And you talked about it a little bit, but how does SIBO impact our hormones and our periods and all of our, and ovulation, everything?
Yeah, so, I mean, the nutrients that we're absorbing are important for all types of hormones. So when we talk about hormones in general, we can talk about thyroid hormones, we can talk about insulin, we can talk about sex hormones like estrogen, progesterone, and it's essential that we have all of these different nutrients in order to activate thyroid hormone, in order to support the liver to detoxify estrogen, in order to reduce inflammation in the body. Inflammation absolutely impacts all of our hormones in our body. So there's many different mechanisms as to which gut imbalances in general, including SIBO, can cause us to have these different types of hormonal imbalances. Now, it's not always the main root cause, but it's definitely a contributor to someone not feeling, you know, optimal maybe throughout certain periods of their menstrual cycle. You know, we tend to already experience some digestive distress during our menstrual cycle, like maybe more constipation during the luteal phase, you know, and throw in SIBO in that situation, you know, you're going to feel a lot more estrogen dominance type symptoms, especially if you're methane dominant and you're not having regular bowel movements. So there's so many different mechanisms as to how they are.
Yeah, it's so interesting because whenever I'm working with a new client and they're coming in with a lot of estrogen dominant symptoms, I'm like, you know what? I know you really want to jump into like Dutch testing first, but I actually think we probably need to like look at GI map and look at SIBO and all these other things. Cause I was like, you're actually probably going to get a lot more relief when we work on the gut. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, because I also have Hashimoto's and I'm convinced all these things are linked together somehow. I don't know what came first, but they're all here now. And so I was talking to my doctor the other day about how hard my SIBO has been to clear. I've been working on it for probably about a year. And I'm really trying to do it as holistically as possible. I have a really bad reaction to antibiotics in general. Like, it's not like I'm against them. I just know for me, it's probably going to do more harm than good in this case. And my doctor agrees with me, thank goodness. But he was telling me, he's like, well, because you have Hashimoto's, SIBO is something we see a lot in patients with Hashimoto's, and it can make it harder to get rid of. So I wanted to ask you about that, like thyroid function, thyroid hormone, SIBO, like what's kind of the download there?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, multiple different mechanisms of the connection between bacterial overgrowth and any sort of thyroid disease. So one, the vitamin deficiencies for absorption of certain types of fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. Inflammation of the gut lining can lead to autoimmune type flares, so making us have more susceptibility to things like food sensitivities. And then there's a lot that actually happens in the gut when it comes to activation of our thyroid hormones from that T4 to the active form of T3, for example. Our gut produces enzymes that help that process. So there's just that basic mechanism. And then there's the idea of the fact that research shows that there's several links between multiple different autoimmune diseases and gut health, because about 70% of our immune system is located in our gut. So it's no surprise that if our gut immune system is stressed out and we have intestinal permeability, meaning things are passing from the gut into the blood that shouldn't be, or creating even more of an autoimmune type reaction, that we're going to see a very strong correlation.
Yeah. Beautifully said. That it just, I just want everyone who's listening to understand the reason these questions sound redundant is because it's to drive home the point that so many things are linked back to our gut. Like, our gut health is truly, I mean, they say like the gut's the second brain. I actually think it's just like the first brain. It's just the gut. Like, it's just that important. It's not second to anything. And then I want to talk about insulin sensitivity and PCOS with SIBO as well, because something else I see around, like when I'm talking to different clients, is they'll have SIBO and PCOS, and then they notice when they're like after their SIBO, their insulin sensitivity seems to be not as good as before. So I want to see if you had ever seen that, like with your SIBO clients having more blood sugar issues than maybe your other clients you work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a great question. And a lot of my clients do have PCOS diagnoses, including also things like endometriosis. And, you know, anytime we have a diagnosis, we're always looking at like, okay, well, what are some of the root causes of, you know, PCOS or endometriosis? And so we're always looking at inflammation as a big part of that. Research shows that there are actually certain types of bacteria that are important in our regulation of carbohydrate metabolism, for example. And so there's one in particular, this specific type of bacteria called Acromantia, that was found at lower levels in individuals who have prediabetes, for example. So we have a bit of research that shows the imbalance of bacteria in the gut does in fact influence our insulin sensitivity and the way that we are going to metabolize carbohydrates. And in addition to that, dysbiosis, meaning an imbalance of bacteria, it also influences how much energy we extract from the food that we eat, which is fascinating, right? To see that the composition of your gut bacteria can determine how much energy you're taking from food. So if you have an imbalance in your gut bacteria that's more negative, pro-inflammatory, you're going to take and absorb more calories than someone else with a healthy gut composition. So in patients that I've found, you know, oftentimes we're working on a lot of things. So gut definitely, I'm sure, is contributing to the fact that they see improvements in their ability to handle, you know, carbohydrates afterwards. But we're also working on things like physical activity. We're also talking about dietary things. So I would imagine that taking a very holistic approach is more important than, you know, the gut definitely plays a role, but all of those lifestyle factors definitely are something that is always part of the plan that I'm working on.
I'm so glad you brought up about the different types of the gut bacteria, because I just think the gut's fascinating. So I'm probably going to say a million times, I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's just crazy to me. When I got diagnosed with Hashimoto's, I gained 15 pounds and I thought it was due to my thyroid. And when I got my GI map run, my doctor was like, oh, no, your thyroid might contribute a little bit to this, but it was actually the different gut bacteria I had in my system, like basically everything that would absorb like an extreme amount of calories from food was high. And I had like 20 different bad bugs in there. And so they were explaining to me, like, that's why this is priority number one, is because you have such like a pro-inflammatory state in your gut right now that really nothing else is going to help until we fix it.
Yeah. And there's the fascinating research when you look at the different drugs that are used, the anti-diabetic drugs like liraglutide and metformin. These have recently been shown to significantly lower body weight and improve glucose metabolism while modifying the composition of the gut microbiome. Several preclinical and clinical studies highlight that metformin modifies the intestinal microbiota by inducing the growth of several different types of bacteria, including the one that I mentioned above, the Akkermansia. So it's interesting that the drugs that we're using to support blood sugar balance also have a positive impact on the gut microbiome. And I think that's no surprise.
That's so interesting. Okay, talk to me about probiotics and SIBO, because this is probably one of the hottest debated topics I've seen on the internet. Like, and I've even read through a bunch of peer-reviewed research, like, it just seems to be heavily debated. So what are your thoughts on probiotics and SIBO?
Mm-hmm. So what's really great about my practice is that I have the ability to use functional stool testing so that I'm looking at everything going on in the client's gut microbiome. So PCR, DNA stool analysis is very specific. And so there's never a one-size-fits-all for anyone. You know, SIBO doesn't typically exist on its own. You know, we might see other things like low immune function. We might see certain things like H. pylori. And those are cases where, you know, certain types of probiotics might actually be used to support that person's system in a multi-stage process for addressing SIBO. It's not often that a client comes to me and the only thing they're doing is a SIBO protocol. A SIBO protocol for me looks like gut lining support, immune support, making sure that we're using polyphenols to not reduce beneficial bacteria while we use antimicrobials. And so there's so much more that goes into how we address SIBO in the first place, but it's important to just keep that in mind.
I think it's really important to keep in mind it's very individualized, because a lot of people think, oh, you just take antibiotics and you're better. And so can you tell us some more about that? Because that's kind of what most conventional doctors recommend, is just a pretty intense course of antibiotics and no other support besides that.
Yeah, and that's the big problem is, you know, when we look at some of the root causes of SIBO, you know, we can see hypothyroidism, we can see, you know, high levels of stress. You and I were talking about this offline. Something for me that was a huge factor in my journey to finding like long-term relief. So those are just two root causes, but, you know, you could have low stomach acid, for example. This could be using proton pump inhibitors, or, you know, I see this a lot with vegan vegetarian diets. They're not getting enough of the right nutrients to support stomach acid production. So there's many different, you know, reasons why it's important to like dig and get to the root cause and make sure that we're not just doing the antibiotics alone. Now, people are afraid of antibiotics, but they're not that bad. The ones specifically used to treat SIBO, like rifaximin and xifaxan, they're very specific to the small intestine. So they're not something that we need to be afraid of, but doing those alone, the actual success rates of doing that in one course of antibiotics and then feeling better long-term is very slim. And so that's why when we use the natural antimicrobials, one of the big benefits is less risk of antibiotic resistance. And then the other benefit is that there's usually bookend like aspects of that protocol that are also going to create more long-term success. We might also use things like pancreatic support for fat absorption, or biofilm disruptors, for example. So it's much more complex than just here's a 14 course antibiotic and, you know, good luck as it comes back in a month or so.
That's the thing I think is so interesting about SIBO is it and just the gut in general, is that it's so specific and so different in every single person. And truly, like, in my opinion, if you're not getting the stool testing and all the other things along with it, it's almost impossible. I mean, I tried to do it on my own for a long time. It's impossible to really figure it out. And it frustrates me that the medical system doesn't necessarily see it that way, because insurance doesn't cover a lot of these tests, which is super frustrating. And that's like probably a whole other podcast that you and I both deal with. Like, I almost hate when I have to tell like a client, I'm like, well, here are the tests. Like, here's what insurance covers. Here's what it doesn't. It feels so frustrating, because the only way to get real relief is to really know exactly what's going on in your own body.
Yeah, and also, speaking of insurance coverage, I mean, people come to me and they're like, well, it was pay for your services and find long-term relief, or pay for the antibiotic that insurance didn't cover in the first place, which costs, you know, $1,000+, some people even a few thousand dollars. So a lot of insurances don't cover the antibiotics that you would need conventionally for SIBO. Also, my pregnancy brain, like, totally forgot to fully answer your question about the probiotics. So I wanted to just expand. I want to just expand a little bit more on the probiotic side of things now that I recall what the question was. Thinking about spore-based probiotics, yeast-based probiotics, and lactobacillus probiotics. So those are kind of like the three classes that I like to categorize probiotics in. I will often use a yeast-based probiotic, like Escalardi, has actually been shown in research to really have great antimicrobial benefits against SIBO. Spore-based probiotics, also generally safe for people with SIBO, also have antimicrobial benefits. The lactobacillus bifidoblends, I believe, are where most of the controversy stands on probiotics and SIBO, because a lot of those strains of the lactobifidoblends actually fuel the fire in terms of feeding bacterial overgrowth. So with the first two that I mentioned, the Escalardi, the spore-based probiotics, these are ones that I have on my probiotic line. These are the ones that I will typically use as part of a protocol, more so than those lactobacillus bifidoblends. And again, using a stool test to see like how much overgrowth they have, how much undergrowth they have, what other, you know, types of yeast or bacteria are overgrown, what does their immune function look like? Because we know that within those three classes, generally speaking, we determine them a little bit better. And then there's also an Acromantia probiotic, which we've talked about a few times throughout the episode, that's really great for metabolic function and also supports that gut lining. So that's another one that we might use that's completely safe to use during.
Amazing. Okay, the other controversial treatment I wanted to talk about, and then we're going to wrap up and give you guys like some hope that this isn't like a hopeless thing, like SIBO does get better. What do you think about the elemental diet? Because that's another one that's on the internet and talked about and debated quite frequently.
You know, I've never used an elemental diet in my practice. I've also never had a client come to me after trying an elemental diet that's been successful. And so I take the least restrictive approach due to the fact that I have not seen compelling evidence that an elemental diet makes sense for any of the clients that I personally work with. And so, you know, therefore, it's not something that I use. Now, is it helpful for certain people? Maybe, but just based on my practice, it's not something that I will use.
I know it got recommended to me, and just with my history of like eating disorder and disordered eating, it just made me too nervous. I was like, I don't think it's something I can do without going all in on. And then that the fallout of that's probably going to be worse. Actually, that leads me to another question. And because if you listen to this podcast, people probably already know that I had a long history with both anorexia and bulimia. And it's not something that I have really gotten a lot of education on. Can eating disorders contribute to SIBO?
Absolutely. And there's actually a lot of overlap between that. I work with a lot of patients who have recovered from eating disorders and now have SIBO. And there's a lot of different reasons why this can happen. Some of it could be the fact that we do see some longer lasting changes to the gut microbiome in someone with, say, anorexia nervosa. We also can see just impaired motility and impaired muscle function, you know, especially if someone's lost a significant amount of weight. We tend to forget that that includes muscle, and there's also muscles, or gut is a muscle, and there's a lot of organs and internal support that we need to be properly nourished for those processes to optimally function. So that's another part of it. You know, and then the immune connection too, right? Just supporting the gut's immune function and, you know, that first line of defense to protect us against things like SIBO and having adequate stomach acid, which can definitely go down significantly in underfeeling or eating disorders due to the fact that we're just not getting the right amount of nutrients to produce stomach acid. So there's a lot of mechanisms as to why. I do see it very, very common in my practice. And, you know, there are some people that are maybe still kind of stuck in that, you know, disordered eating behavior. And I always tell them, you know, we're not going to treat SIBO until, you know, we're fully in recovery here, because it is so important to understand that you can treat candida and H. pylori and SIBO and leaky gut, but if you are in a body that is not properly nourished, doesn't have immune support, motility support, it's just going to come right back. So if you're, you know, someone who's in that place where maybe you've been underfeeling or you've had an eating disorder, restoration, nutrient repletion is priority number one. And I work with patients like, you know, it might be uncomfortable to eat certain foods because they have this bacterial overgrowth. So we work to find ways to keep them comfortable, but there's no sense in going in and doing this massive protocol in somebody who's already undernourished, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's why I've always like leaned away from the elemental diet, just because it's so restrictive. It's basically like a 2-week liquid diet, which is a lot. But wrapping up, we dumped a lot of information. This has been amazing. If you didn't know what SIBO was, now you do. For anyone who's listening, who's like, wow, so much of this sounds familiar, where should they even start? Because, you know, if you go talk to a conventional doctor, a lot of times won't even, to me, this is my personal experience, didn't listen to me. They were like, oh, I don't even know what SIBO is. I had 3 doctors tell me that they didn't know what it was. So where should someone start and like kick off this journey? Or if they've been on it a while and they're really frustrated, like what would you say?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if this is something that you're just starting to explore and that like, oh, all of a sudden all these SIBO symptoms sound like you, it might be a good place to start to just even meet with a dietitian who specializes in digestive health and can say, yeah, you're doing a lot of the right things. You're eating a lot of the, you know, right nutrients. Your lifestyle looks great. Like you're not, you know, you're prioritizing stress. You're not overexercising. And if those things could be enough to improve your symptoms, you might not even need to go further and do SIBO testing. But I think just having that groundwork, because those tend to be things that I end up working with clients on anyway. And so if you can kind of start with the foundational stuff, and then if you still don't feel better, if you're still experiencing symptoms, then it's time to say, okay, let's do a GI map. And then let's also do a SIBO test to make sure that, you know, everything's looking good. But start foundational, then go to big picture. If you're someone who's been on this journey for a while, maybe there's missing factors to your, you know, healing journey. Maybe you haven't addressed the stress. Maybe you haven't addressed other overgrowths or imbalances in your body, nutrient deficiencies, or maybe an imbalance in your diet. So those types of things could be missing, and you might have been hydrophobicing on low FODMAP, antimicrobials, and you haven't considered any of the other things that impact your risk for getting SIBO and also your likelihood of success long term.
Yes, totally agree. Foundation is like the perfect place to start and then kind of go from there. So Obviously we talked about the fact you take patients and clients. How can people find you? What does that look like? You've got awesome social media accounts. Where can they learn more?
Yeah, so everything I would direct you to would be nutritionrewired.com. I have group coaching, one-on-one coaching, but also a lot of great free resources like a podcast, a newsletter, a blog. And then, as Kate mentioned, I'm always on social media trying to provide more education for people, because part of my own journey was just lack of education and following all the wrong people. And so my passion is really to help empower individuals as clients to really take control of their health journey and also not get caught up in like dogmatic, you know, religion of nutrition where people are really just trying to sell, you know, their narratives. I think that's something that's really important to keep in mind. So yeah, I'd love to connect with people and just stay in touch. And I just really, really appreciate you having me on, Kate. It's been such a wonderful chat.
Thanks for coming on. I know it's like a lot of it's me asking my personal questions and then like digging in questions other people submitted. So yeah, if you guys feel like you have SIBO symptoms, please don't gaslight yourself. Please look into it. I gaslit myself for like 6 months, and I really wish I would have kind of gotten ahead of it sooner. I let it go on way too long. So if you're feeling uncomfortable, if you're feeling constipated, any of these things, please, please reach out to somebody. Erin, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. If you guys love this podcast, send it to someone. If you have a best friend that always has tummy troubles, they need to listen to this podcast, so send it their way. And I'll link all of Erin's stuff in the show notes per usual so you guys can connect with Erin separately if that's something you're interested in. But thank you so much.